for example, to what speeds up algorithms in quantum computing, that kind of thing. But anyway, we have to start with quantum theory. So what is quantum theory? Obviously, opinions are going to differ wildly, and everyone's got their own personal take on it. So this is just my personal take on it. It's not a complete, fully-fledged physical theory about the way the world works. It's not a complete model of the way the world works. What quantum theory is instead is a framework for how the world works, into which we can slot physical concepts to build up on the scaffolding of quantum theory and create a model that will function. So it doesn't tell you, for example, that charge exists. It doesn't even tell you that objects have mass in and of itself. Those are properties you have to stick onto the side of quantum theory in order to get it to run right. But what it does tell you, rather remarkably, is that regardless of what properties you stick on the side, regardless of whether you're talking about what charged objects do when encountering magnetic fields, or what massive particles do when colliding with one another, or which direction things are going when they're choosing where to go, all these objects follow the same rules. In fact, everything follows the same rules. Photons, electrons, atoms, chemical bonds inside molecules, large-scale macroscopic objects like buckyballs. That's about as macroscopic as we get. This is apparently what Google Images thinks a photon looks like. They all follow the same rules. Whether you're worrying about where a photon goes when it encounters a polarizing beam splitter or something like that, what energy level an electron might be inside an atom, whether a chemical bond is energetically vibrating in a certain mode or not. All these very different, apparently different concepts follow exactly the same rule structure, which is downright odd. And it's more odd because those rules are so damn counterintuitive. They don't make any kind of common sense whatsoever. And the quantum information theory approach is to say, well, forget about mass, forget about charge, forget about the fact we're talking about photons or electrons or what have you. Let's just look at the rules all these systems follow. Let's look at quantum theory itself, the patterns that every physical system obeys, and try and work out what these rules can tell us that we clearly don't intuit already about the world. So as a quantum information theorist, there are really two questions, I guess, that bug you all the time that you focus on. The first question here, I guess, you focus on more when writing grant proposals than anything else. What do these rules let us do? Because they seem to let us do much more than we would suspect we can do. They let us do things like quantum cryptography, for example. They let us do things like quantum computing, factoring numbers faster than seems theoretically possible. And mentioning buzzwords like this is what gets people to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in expensive physics institutes, so it's definitely worth doing. Perhaps what actually gets you up in the morning, if you're more like me, is paranoia. What on earth do all these physical systems know about the way the world works, about the way everything is ordered, that we don't? How on earth are they obeying these strange, exceptionally coordinated behavior patterns? And why are they behaving in this way when clearly it makes no sense whatsoever? That's why you should look at the foundations of quantum theory. What does information have to do with it? Why does that necessarily involve looking at quantum information theory? Well, physics is all about information, basically. When you boil down to the basic ingredients and forget about whether you're looking specifically at position measurements or what the charge on particles is, or how objects rotate around one another, or what have you. What we need to do in physics to get things going is just to observe the world, to get information about the world. And constantly, in every one of our interactions with a physical system, we're basically asking a question about grabbing some physical information from the world. Where is something? When did such and such an event happen? How hot is this liquid or whatever? How charged is this electron? How fast is it moving? Every single measurement we make and every observation we take is an interaction with the world in which we're trying to extract information about a physical system. And it turns out that it's those rules of information exchange that seem to be fundamental to quantum theory. That's the language it's fundamentally formulated in. So, as quantum information theorists, and certainly as this quantum information theorist, I want things to be as simple as possible. I don't want to be looking at extremely complicated measurements. I want to be looking at the very simplest bit of information I can extract from the physical world and focusing on that. Now, traditionally, if you've been brought up in a Newtonian paradigm, you tend to think that the fundamental units of the physical world in which everything's ordered are sort of billiard ball type positions. They're positions of particles or what have you, and momenta for these particles, perhaps. And you just, those are the fundamental properties. You specify all those, press play, and then you get a universe. Now, position is a very fine property. I've got no problems with position as a physical property. It certainly is a property of objects. The problem for me is it's far too complicated. For instance, here's a position measurement of where we are right now. But to specify it, I have to input these two numbers, the first of which, I guess, has a range of about 180 different possible values. And this one has a range of about 360 different possible values. They're independent, so there's 180 times 360, which is quite big, numbers of different possible position states I could be in just to specify my position to this accuracy. That's an awful lot of data. It gets worse because I can specify my position to this kind of accuracy. Unfortunately, that's the Bob room, but we're quite near there. But now, look at the degree of accuracy, the sheer number of different possible data states I have to select between, to measure between, to choose between, just to specify my position to this kind of level of accuracy in the world, which doesn't cut it as far as quantum mechanics is concerned, incidentally. Not at the moment. It's huge. It's preposterously large. In fact, most people tend to think that position is a continuous measurement. So specifying your position can be done to an arbitrary degree of accuracy with a potentially arbitrarily large amount of information. Far, far too complicated for the likes of me. I want to ask the simplest question I can about the world. And the simplest question I can ask is just a binary yes or no, thank you very much. Is an atom in a ground state or not? Yes or no. Is there a photon there or not? Is the cat dead or not, for example? That's the canonical quantum mechanical question. There's only two possible answers to these kind of questions. Whenever we ask a question like this of the physical world, we will only ever get one of two responses. Either the physical world will say yes, or it will say no. Either the cat will be alive or the cat will be dead. We don't, genuinely don't, ever see cats in superposition states of being alive or dead. So this just gives me one little bit of information about the physical world. And that's the kind of interaction with the physical world, the kind of data about the physical world I want to concentrate on. And it's fine to concentrate on that because, in fact, every single thing we can possibly know about the world can be built up from little yes-no questions like this. And yeah, if anyone's ever played the game of 20 questions, that gives you an idea just how quickly piling up yes-no answers to the world can specify a great deal of information. For position-wise, of course, you can narrow it down very quickly with yes-no questions. Am I in the northern or southern hemisphere, western or eastern hemisphere? And you zoom in relatively quickly. So yes-no questions are, in fact, quite sufficient for working out what's going on. And classically, yes-no questions are trivially simple, which is another reason to like them lots. Basically, this is how you'd model the way the world behaves in response to a yes-no question. There are two possible physical states associated with the world. Either the cat is alive, I think that's the no response down there, or the cat is dead, and that's a physical state. The cats, of course, do have physical states. They're either alive or dead. And if the cat is in the yes state, then we get the answer yes, and we have to bury it, which is rather sad. If the cat is in the one state, then we get the answer one, and we get to celebrate, although we might still have our funding taken away for ethical reasons. So that's very simple. It's just two possible answers to the question, two possible physical states. It's a binary yes, no. This is the way the world works. We all know this is the way the world works. Of course, it doesn't. In fact, quantum mechanics tells us that this is the situation. And this is the situation for every single yes, no question we've ever asked about the world that we can stare about in close enough detail. Can't do quantum experiments on cats quite yet. But every object, from photons all the way up to C60 buckyball molecules, all behave according to this structure rather than this structure. There's not just two possible physical states of the system, the naught state and the one state, the yes state and the no state. Instead, there's an infinite set of possible physical states of the system corresponding to a yes-no question that form, in fact, as I'll explain in a bit, the surface of a sphere. That's called the Bloch sphere. Just a continuous, uniform set of possible states transitioning from the yes answer in a way smoothly round to the no answer and everything in between. Which is a bit odd, because what would an in-between state look like? So now I'm going to start digressing into the actual basic ingredients of quantum information theory, which will be easier if I have a piece of chalk. Oh, I think there must be some here. But damn right. Okay. Okay, so some basic rules for the kind of notation I'm going to use when I'm talking about quantum theory. First of all, is Ket notation, which is very simple. Essentially, if we have a physical system such as a cat, then you simply write down what its physical state is. Here's a live cat. Put it inside a ket, which is just it's a vector bracket, basically. It's a straight line and a chevron. And there we have a quantum state. Simple as that. Here's a different quantum state. It's not quite so fun. But for the most part, rather than, because I can't bring up cat symbols on my computer, I'm going to follow the quantum information tradition of just using the values 0 and 1, borrowed from the classical information tradition of the values of a bit, to represent two different physical states. But the key point is they can be anything in the physical world. They can be whether an electron is charged or not, is in an excited energy level or the ground state or not. It can be whether a photon is in a box or not, or whether it went to the left or the right, whether it went through the left slit or the right slit of a two-slit interferometer. It can be anything, any piece of physical information. Just write 0 and 1 as shorthand. The key point about quantum mechanics is there's this continuum of states in between. If these are possible states of a physical system, then in fact any linear combination of them is a physical state. And by linear combination, I mean if I just stick complex numbers, alpha and beta, out the front, the sum of these two states with complex weights here is a valid physical state. And that's all we really see in this Bloch sphere representation. When we've got a sphere of possible states starting up here with the naught state, and down here we've got the one state. Essentially, the continuum as we come down this axis here is just the relative weight of alpha and beta. So up here we've got the naught state, say, which is a happy cat. Here, alpha is very big. In fact, 1, and beta is 0 at the top. So that's a happy cat. Then as we transition down, alpha gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Beta gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the bottom, we have our tragedy. So off to the sides, we can say things like this. Off at this point, we'll have some point where alpha is equal to beta. And then we'll have a state like that, just pure and simply. But as you see, there's a hemisphere here, There's a circle here, and that's because these are complex numbers. So there's a relative phase between the two. So as well as, basically I can write this, if I change it into angle form, this can be something like cos theta over 2 of one state plus sine theta over 2. But there's a complex weight to it, too. So e to the I phi, say, the one state there. And then you can see in this model, this angle here coming down from the top is theta. And then the rotating angle around the axis here on the sphere is phi. And that's how we get a block sphere, a continuous sphere of possible pure cat states, or electron states, or position states, or any states of any physical system there is. Now, we refer to these states here, these basic building block states, the naught and the one state, as basis states for the system. And that's because you can think of them as vectors in a vector space, a complex dimensional vector space as it happens, but that's not so important. Any linear combination of two vectors is, of course, another vector. And all it takes is for these vectors to be different. And you can get from anywhere in the space to anywhere else in the space just by using the appropriate weights for these two vectors. So in fact, just by specifying two possible states of the system, two possible outcomes of a measurement, alive and dead, for example, I can use the states corresponding to those outcomes as notation to write down any possible physical state of the system like so. And that's what we mean by a basis set, naught, one, for example. Now, there's something more to these weights, alpha and beta here. It turns out they're actually, they have real physical meaning. In that if you do open the box, look at the cat, perform whatever measurement you need to perform on a cat to work out whether it's alive or dead, you'll find that the values of alpha and beta determine the probabilities with which you will find the cat in one state or the other. Specifically, they're complex numbers. So if you just take the size of the complex number and square it, that will give you the probability of getting this result. So here, for example, where the numbers are equal, there's half a chance, there's a probability of one half of the cat being alive and one half the cat being dead. If we were up here, where alpha is much, much bigger than beta, it would be much more likely that the cat would be alive than it would be dead were we to perform a measurement. But it's still a purely probabilistic outcome, whether it flips one way or the other. There's nothing special, incidentally, about these two points on the block sphere. And that's perhaps something that's most difficult to grasp when you consider that this is the way every yes-no binary question in the world behaves. The answers you chose to phrase your binary question in, the states I chose here to represent my basis for this sphere, alive and dead, are kind of arbitrary. There's no real obvious physical significance to them with relation to the system in and of itself. I could equally well have chosen these two states. That's a minus sign there. So cat alive plus cat dead, or cat alive minus cat dead, and they would work fine. I can represent any state in my system as a linear combination of these two vectors, too. I just have to use different numbers from alpha and beta. And in fact, this would represent a valid measurement on the system, too. If I could somehow work out a way to measure a cat and work out whether it's alive plus dead or alive minus dead, that's actually a valid thing to do. And it would have a valid answer, and the answer would correspond to the complex number in front of whichever element in the superposition I'd be looking at. But we have to ask a binary question. That's the key point. What you can't ever do is work out exactly where on this sphere of possible states you are at any given time. All you can ever do is ask a binary question. Pick two points on the sphere, two opposite poles, and say, well, which of these two are you? And the system will give you an answer probabilistically. And then perhaps there's something called wave function collapse, and the system collapses onto that state, and the cat is alive ever after until you perform the next experiment. Which is good. But prior to the measurement, the cat might have been in some other state entirely, and you can never know precisely which state that was. All you'll ever find out is yes, no, an answer to a binary question, get a single bit of information from the system. So this here is just showing that I can use any basis, 0, 1, 0, minus 1, or 0, 1, to represent the physical state of a system. So I just use different complex numbers out front, and that's fine. Now, you can kind of understand the uncertainty principle in this framework, which seems kind of odd, because the uncertainty principle tends to be phrased in terms of position and momentum measurements, which are, you know, great big complex things. You can kind of understand why it's hard to keep track of where something is at any given time. But if all we've got is just one simple question, one yes-no subject of inquiry, how do we get uncertainty about the answer to that? It only ever gives a definite answer. Well, the answer is simply a definite answer to which of the infinite number of possible questions you can ask the system. If you've got a system that's in some state here, so let's say it's in the let's say the cat is in the alive plus dead state here on the block sphere, and we open the box, we perform a measurement to work out whether the cat is alive or dead. Well, actually, before performing this measurement, if the cat's in this state, we're in a state of maximum uncertainty about what the outcome of the measurement will be along this axis, the 0-1 axis. With 50% probability, we'll get the result 0. With 50% probability, we'll get the result 1, which basically means we know nothing. So that we're really uncertain beforehand about this particular outcome. But if we were to perform a different measurement, if we were to perform a 0 plus 1, 0 minus 1 measurement, we'd know for sure which outcome we were going to get. We'd get this outcome all the time, and this outcome exactly never. So we'd be in a state of maximum certainty about this possible measurement. And you can probably clearly see here, there's a direct trade-off. Wherever you are on the block sphere, whichever state you're in, there's always one measurement about the outcome about which you're going to be maximally certain. In balance against that, there's going to be a whole range of measurements about which you're less certain, and less certain, and less certain, and an entire equator of measurements about which you know nothing whatsoever. You can't possibly, the outcome of those is completely, perfectly unpredictable. So uncertainty is, in that sense, at the heart of every single measurement you can ever perform, regardless of how simple. So this is the basic ingredient of quantum information. This is how physical information actually behaves. This is the way our world works, which is slightly odd. But if we want to ignore that, if we want to keep our heads in the sand and stick resolutely to the classical worldview, we can just evolve systems which always either stay in the naught state or stay in the one state, and they never really interact too much. And you know, a lot of macroscopic objects behave this way. Due to something called decoherence, which I won't go into, but suffice to say, cats are an example. You can be fairly confident that cats will always stay in the naught state or stay in the one state for all practical purposes. And if we never inquire too deeply about fundamental objects and we never enact any complicated operation on cats that flips their state in a non-trivial way, then we just get classical theory out. Quantum theory with just the naught and the one state involved is just classical theory. The thing is, reality doesn't behave this way. Reality is more complicated. And in fact, there's a whole range of possible physical operations, possible procedures we can enact over and above this, we seem to be able to do more with reality, or at least reality seems to be able to do more. And from a quantum information theory perspective, we'd really like to know what we can do. That's the practical grant proposal question, and also what on earth reality is doing behind our backs, which is the paranoid question. Okay. So I'll just pause there briefly. Are there any questions at this point? So the basic ingredients of quantum information. I'll move on to entanglement next. Sure. So could you, if you had a probability of 1 to 1, did you say? Yeah. With respect to the measurement you're mentioning, which is the 0-1 measurement, no, there isn't any difference in terms of the observed outcomes. Because basically we've got these numbers in front, alpha and beta. And all that matters as far as the probability of an outcome is involved is the magnitude of those complex numbers squared. So clearly, although this is a -1, -1 squared is 1. I mean, one thing you'll notice, because I've already started doing it, quantum information theorists are notoriously sloppy about normalizing everything. So technically, there's a 1 over root 2 in front of all these objects. So the complex number in front of this is 1 over root 2. If I square it, I get a half. That's the probability of getting that result. Ditto over here. And that's true whether this is -1, whether it's 1 over root 2, e to the I theta, whatever. But if I were to perform, there is a real physical difference between these points. If I were to perform a different measurement in a different axis, then there'd be genuinely different probabilities of different outcomes associated with that. There's no direct relationship between the possible physical states and the measurement choice. So if you think about it, the possible physical states, that's just a smooth featureless sphere of possible states, basically. And I just pick an arbitrary axis through that to determine any given measurement. And that's fine, but that my choice of measurement won't in and of itself influence the physical state of the system itself. Although after the measurement, it will collapse such that it's lying somewhere along that axis. Any more questions? Okay, entanglement. Entanglement is one of the weirder concepts in physics. It's a direct consequence of this superposition rule. This simple rule that if you have any two physical states, then any complex superposition of those physical states is another valid physical state. Just springs directly from that. But we have, in order to get entanglement, we simply have to apply that to more than one object at once. What entanglement seems to suggest is that distant events can be spookily correlated with each other. I mean, Einstein, I think, called it a spooky. Spooky action at a distance, spooky correlation at a distance, something like that. Even in situations where we can't work out a way in which they can possibly be communicating with one another, and where relativity, in fact, tells us that they can't, period, be communicating with one another. Seems weird, this kind of correlation, and that's why entanglement is pretty much certainly, from my perspective, the most abused notion in all of physics. It's constantly coming up in every little nook and cranny of pseudoscience you encounter, whether it's homeopathy or clairvoyance or remote healing or ESP, telekinesis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've heard countless invocations of quantum mechanics and specifically quantum entanglement to explain how the universe is all connected with itself and everything knows everything else and isn't it all great that we're all connected and it's all pretty much nonsense. But what actually is entanglement? That's what I hope to address. Suppose we have two elementary quantum systems rather than one. So I've drawn this here, so I might as well use it. Here's elementary system number one, and here's elementary system number two. I'm going to call this elementary system Alice, because it belongs to Alice, who's sat over on this side of the blackboard. And I'm going to call this elementary system Bob, because it belongs to Bob. All I'm thinking here are just two physical systems. They can be anything you like. The following analysis, they can be different. This can be an atom, that can be a cat. But they could both be atoms, and we're asking whether they're in the excited state or the ground state or anything like that. So there are four possible answers to two binary questions. This is a binary question Alice can ask her system. Is my atom in the excited state or a ground state? That's a binary question Bob can ask his system. And there are four possible answers here, clearly. Just yes, 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 no, no, yes, no, no. Very simple from a classical perspective. And here I can just notate those answers the way we tend to in quantum information theory is 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 1. It's just the possible answers to two measurements on two basic quantum systems. But if those four states, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1, are possible physical states of the system, which they certainly are, then any complex superposition of those four states must also be a valid physical state. So taking four complex numbers, alpha 0, 0, plus beta 0, 1, plus gamma 1, 0, plus delta 1, 1, must be a valid physical state of the system. Now, this is where we get entanglement from, this superposition principle. Consider first, though, this possible state. So these are the proper weights I can assign here, a half in front of every single one of these terms here. If I perform this measurement, if I perform these 0, 1 measurements on this physical state, so just measuring the excitation level of atoms, for example, that were in this quantum state beforehand, I get each of these answers. You just do what you normally do. You square the complex number in front here, the magnitude thereof, to get the probability. So a half squared is a quarter. There's a quarter chance of getting the result. Well, we're both pretty excited. A quarter chance of getting the result, well, one of us is, and that's Bob. Well, Alice. Not sure what naught means and what one means anymore. There's a quarter chance of each. But what that means is that a measurement by Alice over here on her system is going to yield zero information about what Bob's system's like. Say Alice performs her measurement and gets the result 1. Well, that means that Bob's system is either in state 0 or it's in state 1. And the relative probability of those two outcomes is the same. So consequently, Alice's measurements have no relationship, no correlation whatsoever with Bob's measurement outcomes. And the system's not entangled in the slightest. So even though we've maximally used every possible state and matched them together as far as possible, what we've actually got in consequence is two completely independent, unentangled systems. But if we're slightly cleverer, we can get a correspondence here. Consider this state instead. This is 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1 over root 2, 1, 1. These are valid numbers. I'm just setting beta and gamma equal to 0 here, which I'm perfectly entitled to do. I can use any complex superposition I like. Still a valid physical state. Now what happens when I measure the system? Well, suppose Alice and Bob perform these excitation measurements. With probability 1 over root 2 squared, i.e. 1 half, they'll get the result 0, 0. Which means Alice sees her atoms excited, and Bob also sees his atoms excited. With probability 1 half, Alice and Bob both see their atoms as being unexcited. But now there is a correlation. There's a very strong correlation, in fact. The moment Alice measures her particle, she'll instantly know what Bob's system is going to do, how it's going to respond to Bob's measurement. She knows that whether or not Bob's performed the measurement already. She knows that whether or not Bob is on Alpha Centauri, space-like separated away from Alice. She instantaneously knows what's going to happen over here. And that's kind of entanglement. In fact, a lot of accounts of entanglement will stop there and say, wow, Isn't that spooky that Alice can somehow know on Earth what's going on in Alpha Centauri instantly? Crazy. But that shouldn't impress you. That is a maximally entangled quantum state. But that kind of correlation I've just described is pretty trivial, actually, in the following way. I can generate it with my socks. My socks are in quite separate locations, and you can only see one of them. But the fact that this sock is black ought, I hope, to convince you that with some degree of probability greater than 1/2, this sock is probably black as well, which it is. But somehow, observing one physical system over here instantaneously gave you, as long as you rely on my sartorial judgment, information about another physical system at quite a separate location. This isn't so strange. So why am I wittering on about this? Like perhaps it's going to lead to something odd. Because this kind of correlation is trivially omnipresent in the world. It's interactions like this that just help us get through the day. Because these things have a shared history. They were in my sock drawer together. Actually, they weren't, but my sock drawer was rather disorganized. But nevertheless, they have some kind of shared history, these socks, such that one can explain why they're always found in pairs. So what about this quantum mechanical system here, where we've got the state 1 over root 2, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. Well, so long as we stick to measurements in the 0, 0 basis and the 1, 1 basis, in the 0, 1 basis, measurements up and down here and up and down here, we're always going to find correlations identical to the sock correlations. And that shouldn't convince us of anything spooky going on whatsoever. We always either get the result 0, 0 half the time, or we get the result 1, 1 half the time. And that's that. But what if we ask a slightly different question? What happens then? According to quantum mechanics, we should be able to ask completely different questions. In particular, we should be able to ask, Alice should be able to decide quite independently from Bob that she's going to diverge from the measurement protocol. And she's going to measure this instead, 0. She's going to distinguish between 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1. Bob might decide the same thing. I mean, maybe there's some spooky coincidence here whereby, I mean, they both toss a coin. Bob might decide to distinguish between 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1 on his system. So let's just look at what would happen in that circumstance. And hopefully by looking at this, you'll see just how incredibly simple quantum mechanics can be when it's written in Ket notation form. I want to work out what would happen between the difference between two different possibilities here. One is the possibility that entanglement is doing something odd. So we focus on this quantum state here and see how it behaves when we're performing this measurement. The other possibility is that entanglement isn't doing something odd at all. And what we really have is a sock-like situation where, with probability 1/2, the socks are in one state beforehand. And with probability the other 1/2, the socks are in a different state beforehand. Okay? So what would happen in these two circumstances? Well, to work it out, all we need to do is just express the state of these systems in this measurement basis, and then see which complex numbers are in front of which terms in the superposition. And that'll tell us the probabilities of the relative outcomes of our measurements, tell us how the measurement's going to go. So, if I say I've got this state here, that means with probability 1/2, I've got the state 0, 0. Now, 0 can be expressed in terms of these states. If I just use the notation whereby I'm going to write for shorthand plus as shorthand for 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1, and minus for 1 over root 2, 0 minus 1. If I just use that notation, it shouldn't be too hard to see that the state naught is just equal to plus minus, and 1 is equal to plus minus minus. And this is where you can see that the linear quantum mechanics is all based on simple linear algebra, basically. And at this point, it's at its most linear and most simple. Naught is equal to plus plus minus in the superposition, simply because you can see if you add these two together, the 1 terms are going to cancel, the naught terms are going to sum together. We're going to be left with all naught and zero, no 1, so we're going to get naught. So this is the naught state. Ditto, if we subtract 1 from the other, the naught terms are going to cancel, the 1 terms are going to add up, we're going to be left with all 1 and no naught. So these are the 2 ways to translate these states into this, the language of this measurement. So if we do that for the naught-naught state, what do we get? We lose our eraser. If we do that for the naught-naught state, what you'll find is that naught is equal to plus minus. Naught is equal to plus plus minus. So naught-naught is actually equal to plus plus, plus plus minus, plus minus plus, plus minus minus. That's all it is. So what we have here is an equal superposition of all 4 possible terms. Now, okay, so technically there ought to be a 1 over root 2 there, and there ought to be a 1 over root 2 here. So here there's a 1 over 2. Multiplying those together. And we find that if we perform a measurement in the plus-minus basis, and the state was naught-naught beforehand, then with probability 1/4, we'll get each individual outcome, each of the possible outcomes. We'll get they'll both find their systems in the plus state, they'll both find their systems in the minus state, they'll find their systems are in opposite states. Each individual possibility with probability 1/4, if we start off in the naught-naught state. Now, if we instead start in the 1-1 state, we'll see that these are actually minus signs here. And in fact, we'll get a minus sign out in front here and a minus sign out in front here. But this shouldn't worry us too much, because if it's in the 1-1 state, we need to square these values to get the relative probabilities, and minus 1/2 squared is 1/4, plus 1/2 squared is 1/4. So we get the same situation, each of these possibilities with probability 1/4. So in other words, it really doesn't matter which of these states we have to start with. We'll always get the same measurement outcomes if our system is in the kind of sock-like state, either they're both black or they're both white. And we get this state that we know, because we've already looked at it, isn't correlated at all. There's no correlation between Alice's outcome here and Bob's outcome. In fact, Alice gets plus, is equally likely to get plus, whether Bob got the result plus or Bob got the result minus. So by starting with a sock-like classical correlated state, we just randomly performed any old measurement rather than the specific measurement in which our socks were constructed. We find the correlation's lost completely. We can't hang on to it. But with entanglement, things are rather different. If we try to follow this state through, it's again a simple matter of linear algebra. What happens when we measure this state, if this is the quantum system? Well, naught-naught, as we've seen, translates to plus-plus, plus-plus-minus, plus minus plus, plus minus minus. And 1-1 translates to plus plus, minus plus minus, minus minus plus, plus minus minus. All summed by 1 over root 2 times various things. But what happens here is these terms cancel. These minus signs matter because we're inside an entangled state. these terms cancel before we get to work out what the coefficients are. And this is just, by simple algebra, this is equal to one over root two times plus plus, plus minus minus. That's the same as the 0,1 state. It's identical, just in a different basis. But it hasn't changed it at all. So in other words, by randomly choosing a different measurement basis, we haven't destroyed the correlations. The correlations are just as strong as ever they were. And that's really the property of entanglement that takes it beyond classical correlation, that takes it beyond SOX. It's the fact that regardless of what questions we ask physical systems, even though the physical systems don't know in advance what questions we're going to ask them, even though Bob and Alice have no idea whether we're going to ask them the same question or a different question, or what of the infinite different possible questions we can pose their systems we're going to ask, they still manage to come up with exceptionally correlated answers like this. And that's something you simply can't do with you can't do it with SOX. Therefore, I conclude you can't do it with classical mechanics at all, which happens to be true. Now, the reason people find this strange, and the reason people find this highly counterintuitive, is somehow, imagine you're Alice and you perform this plus-minus measurement, or you perform the 0,1 measurement. If you perform the 0,1 measurement, you might get the result 0, say. Or if you perform the plus-minus measurement, you might get the result plus here. So these are two possible results for two different things you might do. If you get the result 0, you'll instantly know that Bob's system is going to behave as though it's in this state. You can predict in advance how it's going to respond to any measurement Bob might perform on it. You'll be able to predict in advance that if Bob were to perform a 0,1 measurement, he'd get this result with certainty. And you know this instantly, even though Bob might be on Alpha Centauri. Bob might already have performed his measurement. He might not have performed his measurement yet. He might be space-like separated from you. You instantly know something about something, a physical system that's miles away that you didn't know before. But if you'd done something slightly different, if you'd measured in the plus-minus basis, you'd know something quite different. You'd know instantly about a system miles away that's not causally connected with you in any way, shape, or form, that it's in the plus state. And that's kind of confusing, because surely it ought to be in the same state regardless of what you were doing 4 light years away. But that's not the way it seems to work. And for this reason, people start to think, well, hang on a second, relativity's in trouble here. It's going to collapse because Alice can start signaling faster than light to Bob. All Alice has to do is choose which basis in which she measures, choose whether to measure in the 0 basis or the 1 basis. And then she's going to be signaling to Bob 0 or plus, 0 or plus. And Bob, these are quite different physical states, so surely Bob ought to be able to detect which of these two signals he's getting, at which point, you know, Bob can then signal back to Earth and persuade Alice's grandmother to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the entire causal structure of the world collapses. But this can't happen. And this is the reason, it's this property that gets people talking about quantum telepathy and quantum entanglement in all kinds of woo ways. But there can be no signaling between Alice and Bob, despite the fact that there's this spooky correlation. We can also show that there's no way for Alice to signal any information to Bob, because Alice has no control over the outcome of her measurement here. Regardless of whether we're in this state here, where each particle has an equal possibility of outcomes, or this state here, where only two of these possibilities can occur, Alice has no control whatsoever over the individual outcome of her particular measurement. So if she performs in the 0,1 basis, she's got a probability of 1/2 of getting either result. Ditto, if she performs in the plus-minus basis, she's got a probability of 1/2 of getting either result. This is true whatever axis she chooses. You can't escape from this with an entangled state. So she can choose whether to perform a measurement in this axis. But then she's going to get either this state 50% of the time or this state 50% of the time. So in other words, she can, if you want to talk in the language of influencing, which I think is misleading, but this is the best way to treat the signaling model. This is how the signaling model would have to work. Alice would have to be influencing this system to either collapse into one state here with 50% probability or the opposite state with 50% probability. But these two states have exactly opposite properties. For instance, for any measurement Bob can perform on any axis, there's going to be some probability alpha here and some probability beta here of getting any particular... Sorry. It's going to be alpha plus beta, and then it's going to be... Oh, okay. There's going to be some probability associated with this angle here, how close it is to Bob's measurement outcome. With this state for producing this result. So this state will produce this measurement result much more often than it produces this measurement result, directly proportionally to this angle. So half the time, if Bob's in this state, he'll more likely get this result than this result. But half the time, if he's in this state, and exactly in proportion, he'll more likely get this state than that state as a result. And in consequence, whatever measurement Bob performs, in whatever basis, he's always going to get an outcome, one outcome 50% of the time, and the other outcome 50% of the time. So whatever basis Alice chooses to try signaling to Bob, Bob always just picks up random noise when he's studying his system. He always gets a random output. And in fact, the random output he's getting here is identical to what he would expect if Alice hadn't performed a measurement at all. In fact, when Alice was performing her initial measurement, and she got one result with 50% probability and the other result with 50% probability. Maybe that was the result of Bob trying to signal to her and failing miserably. So when you have an entangled system, it's only when you study the results after the fact. It's when Alice and Bob come together 2 light-years away from Earth, 2 light-years away from Alpha Centauri in between, and they compare notes on what they did. It's only in that circumstance that any of these correlations ever start to emerge, and people go... see that what looked like perfectly independently random behavior is instead perfectly correlated random behavior, which is spooky, but it does mean that relativity survives. We're not able to send signals back to assassins to kill our own grandfathers, and so on and so forth, which is good in a way, although perhaps slightly disappointing for those of us who like warp drives and such like. And it's the randomness. It's the randomness inherent in quantum theory that guarantees that it's at least potentially compatible with relativity in some basic way. And that, in fact, it's compatible with the world having causal time-like structure. But in spite of that, of course, there's still a lot of oddness here about entanglement, because somehow the physical state of Bob's system, even if we can't signal what it is to Bob so that he knows in advance, does seem to be affected, or the quantum state of Bob's system is affected by the outcome of Alice's measurement, which is just downright odd. And it's this extreme degree of correlation over and above what's classically possible, over above what you can do with not just a pair of socks, but even if you give Alice and Bob an infinite number of socks each, of all kinds of different colors of the rainbow, and ask them to conspire ahead of time to produce correlations like this, they can't do it. There's no way they can produce a conspiracy, even if they've got Encyclopedia Britannica's of strategies in front of them, for mimicking these correlations where they don't know in advance what measurements they're going to be performing. But quantum systems do this all the time. So it's this strength of correlation over and above what's classically possible that's called quantum non-locality, which suggests that in some way what's fundamental here is not the individual system over here and the individual system here. The fundamental physical system that's evolving here is the joint system of both together. And the parts don't sum to the whole when studied individually. They sum to much less than the full picture. Why does the universe behave in this way? Why do we have this crazy conspiracy where not only are individual systems behaving in highly counterintuitive ways, but collections of systems are behaving in highly counterintuitive, damn well correlated ways, which we're not going to find out about until we study the correlations after the fact. Why on earth would the world behave like that? That's what quantum information theory is studying. And there is no real answer to that question yet. That's the big unknown. So that's really why. This is a picture of John Bell, the first guy to prove that quantum mechanics was non-local in this sense. We don't know. It's odd. And I guess that's where I'm going to trail off into get more incoherence, because that's the situation. We have no idea what's going on. It's just odd. It's quantum theory. Right. What's the time? Okay, thanks very much. Odd stuff, yeah. For this particular state, that's the way it's set up, yes. So if you perform identical trials on both systems, you get the same answers. This is just one example of an entangled state. I could write down a different state, for example. Here's a different state. Naught one minus one naught. That has the opposite property, that if you perform the same trial on both systems, you'll always get the opposite results. You'll always get anti-correlated results. And you can arbitrarily shift this round such that it can be, this property can be related to different, that measurement here can be perfectly correlated with a measurement on a different axis over here. That's fine too. That's just, it requires you to put some slightly different numbers here. There's an infinite set of possible, there's always an infinite set of quantum states. There's an infinite set of possible maximally entangled states, which we're dealing with every possible set of perfect correlations. One important property of entangled states is that the correlations persist even when you don't. I mean, even when you don't measure in the preordained measurement bases here, in which the results are always the same or always perfectly different, there's still a strong correlation between the results. So, if I, for example, in this for the state I had up previously. If Alice was measuring in the 0-1 basis and Bob measuring in a slightly diverged basis here, we still get this strong correlation where when we look at the results afterwards and compile up the statistics, Alice will always see that whenever she measured in the 0 result and got the state in the up result here, Bob was always getting this outcome with a probability very close, dependent to theta, and hardly ever getting this outcome here because this angle here is so huge. So the correlations persist regardless of what measurements Alice and Bob perform. Yeah. I think the first, I don't think it's first observed in physical systems so much. I think it first really, the first mention of the word entanglement is by Erwin Schrödinger in about 1935. So quantum mechanics is basically written down 26, 27, 28, people start arguing about it. By 1935, it takes about 7 years before they spot this, essentially. And in 1935, they suddenly spot that, hang on a second, these rules we've described, we've just written down for how the world works, tell us that the world works in this way. Schrodinger causes entanglement. And then things happen quite quickly. Einstein, that very same year, published a paper with two chaps called Podolsky and Rosen, which has since become the famous, well, what's famous if you're a quantum information theorist, the EPR paper. It's the most highly cited paper in the field, I suspect. Where they basically, paraphrasing here, but they basically said, look at this, look what quantum mechanics says. It says that systems behave in this correlated fashion according to entanglement. Therefore, something odd is going on, and quantum mechanics can't be right. Must be wrong. Einstein really didn't like this at all. That then got them into an argument, because a lot of people at the time were quite keen on quantum mechanics, for obvious reasons. There was a long-running dispute, basically, about whether this property of quantum systems meant that quantum mechanics can't be right. Not can't be the complete story. There must be some hidden property over here that's controlling the outcome, which is correlated, just like my socks, with a hidden property over here. Whereas there are other people saying, well, there are no socks. It's just all the socks are brought into existence by the measurement you perform and such like and so forth. And it all gets slightly metaphysical and logical positivist. And in the end, it's this chap right here in the very early 60s, John Bell, who proved, if there's time, actually, I'll show you a proof, that there is no collection of socks. There's no possible collection of socks that Alice and Bob could share, such that they could reproduce these correlations in advance for every possible angle. I could make measurements here, and every possible angle I could make measurements here. It just can't be done. In fact, there's a wide gap between what can be done with socks and what can be done with a quantum state. Socks, incidentally, are, that's the language he uses. If you want to read, he's got a marvelous paper called Monsieur Berthelmann's Socks and the Nature of Reality, which is probably the most lucid explanation of non-locality I've ever read. So he proved it in the 1960s. That he showed once and for all, just mathematical proof, quantum mechanics says this does happen, and it can't possibly happen if there's some hidden underlying property of these systems that's guiding it. Hidden underlying properties aren't enough. There must be some form of non-local connection between the two. And then people started taking notice, and people actually started to get suspicious that maybe there was a way to experiment to prove it was wrong. And throughout the 70s, they performed experiments on systems involving, usually involving photons. The usual way to do this is to send a photon off in one direction and a photon off in the other direction, and then measure the two photons independently. Throughout the 70s, people couldn't work out a way to perform the measurements in a space-like separated fashion, because that requires a great deal of timing. You've got two experiments to perform, and you've got to get one experiment over and done with before a light signal can get from that experiment to the other experiment. You basically need either a very, very large laboratory or some very, very clever timing. And in the end, in 1982, a guy called Alain Aspect in Paris, sorry, this is taking ages to explain. In 1982, a guy called Alain Aspect in Paris and his group finally managed to do the experiment so damn fast that no light signal could possibly get from the Alice side of the room to the Bob side of the room. Before the experiment was over. And that experiment showed that these correlations are perfectly accurate. So unless you're a complete conspiracy theorist, and there are a few complete conspiracy theorists in physics, you at that point think, well, look, quantum mechanics must be right. And yes, Einstein was very clever for pointing out all the implications here, but his intuition on it was wrong. So that's the basic history of it. Not at all, because I don't know much about relativity, but no, precisely because there's no signaling. But there's no rule in relativity that says there can't be correlation between distant events. There's a rule in relativity that says you can't essentially accelerate objects beyond the speed of light. You can't actually accelerate them to the speed of light if they're massive. And massless objects travel if they're photons at the speed of light, by definition. That's implicit in that is a kind of rule that you can't send physical signals faster than the speed of light. But there's no rule that says Alice and Bob can't behave in a slightly correlated fashion for whatever spooky reason. A lot of people think it breaks the spirit of relativity in that fashion, and certainly breaks the kind of intuitions you build up learning relativity about the way light cones work and events outside light cones work. But it doesn't break the rule. Maybe bends it slightly. It doesn't break it. It is seriously tricky to do, I suppose. I mean, people have started. It's still a kind of high tech thing. What I'll show you is I'll show you a proof that the kind of way these proofs work as to why the universe is non-local. If there's time, so wave at me if there's not time. Okay. So this is the way these proofs actually work. They're quite simple in a way. This is something called the magic square proof. It kind of helps to understand what I mean when I say these correlations can't possibly be enacted using classical means. This is a way of the proof structure called the pseudo-telepathy game, where you imagine Alice and Bob are players. And basically, we're going to seal them in glass booths in two different parts of our game show. And challenge them. We're going to ask them questions, which are just the equivalent of physical measurements, basically. We're just going to ask Alice and Bob a question each, which is like picking a measurement. And all they have to do is make sure their answers are correlated in some fashion to these questions. And we'll make it easy for them. We'll tell them, we'll give them in advance information about which questions we're going to ask them. And we'll tell them what correlations we expect them to reproduce. So in that kind of circumstance, you'd think it's pretty easy, surely, for Alice and Bob to pass the test and win the game show. But it's not always, because we can set them really, really nasty challenges, like the Magic Square game here. Imagine you're Alice and Bob in these two glass booths. We're going to base our game, this is me explaining how the game works. We're going to base the game around the Magic Square. And the magic square is magic for this reason. Every column sums to an odd number in the magic square. Every entry, every one of the nine entries is either 0 or 1. Let's start by specifying that. Every column sums to an odd number, and every row sums to an even number. If you can probably see quite quickly why it's magic. So I might start, if all the columns odd sum to an odd number, then clearly every entry in the square, when added together, sums to an odd number, because odd plus odd plus odd equals odd. But clearly, if every row adds to an even number, even plus even plus even is even. So we can conclude from that inconsistency that magic squares are magic because they just don't exist. There is no assignment of zeros and ones to these nine squares such that the conditions for it being a magic square are satisfied. But we're going to be evil, and our challenge to Alice and Bob is to convince us that they're thinking of an actual, real, existing magic square. So clearly, at this point, they might be a bit despondent. But we're going to make things easy for them, slightly easier for them. I'm just going to ask Alice to pick a column at random from, a row at random for Alice. And she has to tell me what it is. So I'll just specify a row. Say the two row for Alice. I'll just ask Alice, what's row two in the magic square you're thinking of? And she'll have to respond with three numbers, which sum to an even number. Otherwise, I'm going to catch her out immediately. It'd be very foolish to respond with three numbers that sum to an odd number. She'll respond with, for example, she might respond 0, 0, 0. That would be a valid response. I'd be happy with that. She might respond 011. That would also be a valid response. But she's got to produce some kind of set of numbers. Well, Bob, in a different glass booth, meanwhile, I'm going to ask to tell me a row, sorry, a column. And he's got to produce three numbers that sum to an odd number. Not one would work, for example. And if their answers correlate like this, if I've asked Bob for column three, and Alice for row two, and Alice tells me 000, and Bob tells me 001, I haven't caught them out, because they agree on this number. So they're not necessarily lying. They might be thinking of the same square. So in that case, I'm going to let them pass the game. There are four squares I haven't asked them about, but hey, you can't have everything. They can win. Now, the problem comes that Alice and Bob don't know which column and which row I'm asking the other one. So, for example, any truth assignment for a magic square always falls down at some point, right? I can set the top row to 110, for example, and I'm on track to produce a correct magic square. It sums to an even number. The first column I can set to 100, still works. Second column, it's got to sum to an odd number. So let's say 011, still works. Second row has to sum to an even number, and I've now put a 0 and a 1 in the first two squares, so the last number has to be 1. But we're still on track. But now the bottom right-hand square, we're screwed, because it's got to be both 0 and 1. All magic squares get screwed on the final square. And consequently, if you're Alice and Bob, there's always a 1 in 9 chance, regardless of which magic square or supposedly pseudo-magic square you were thinking of beforehand, there's always a 1 in 9 chance that I'm going to ask you about a column and a row which coincide on the square that's wrong, on the square that you just can't produce a correct answer for. And they can't switch between magic squares to keep dodging my inquiries, because they don't know which question I'm asking them. If I suppose Alice, suppose that this is the error-prone square here in the bottom right, and I ask Alice about row three, and she gets a sinking feeling, thinking, "Oh, he's asked me about row three. This looks bad." She can't switch her answer from what it would have been to something slightly different, which might work, because she doesn't know whether Bob actually has been asked question three and is thus on course for disaster, or whether Bob's been asked some other question. Because if Bob's been asked some other question, she has to stick to their agreed plan. Because if she diverges from the agreed plan, this answer will be different instead, and we'll catch them out that way. So in other words, classically, for the simple reason that magic squares don't damn well exist, and it's a completely unfair game show, Alice and Bob can't possibly win this. We're asking them to produce impossible correlations between their answers. I mean, all I'm asking them to do is just correlate their answers in this fashion, right? It's a way of correlating their answers to a set of one or three questions here and a set of one or three questions here. That's all I'm asking, but it's impossible for them to do it. Except it's not impossible if they share an entangled state. And this is how you prove that, this is one of the ways of proving that entanglement really is very odd. If Alice and Bob share this entangled state here, so it's just each of them have two very elementary quantum systems, two cats in boxes or whatever they want to use to encode their quantum information, and they prepare this entangled quantum state to start with. So it's an equal superposition of four different possible states of their system. This state, just obviously it means that if they measured in the 0-1 basis on each of their four qubits, each of their four systems, they'd have each possible probability, each of these outcomes would occur with probability 1/4. But if they do some funky stuff instead, I'm not going to go through the funky stuff, but if they perform some rotations on their system and essentially measure in slightly different bases on each system, according to the questions they're asked. So this is determining exactly what basis, what angles Alice would measure at if she was asked question one. They just follow this measurement plan for what to measure when they're asked the questions. They can wind up transforming their system into a state like this, where instead of being in a superposition of four possible states, it's kind of in a superposition of eight possible states in their measurement basis. But they're eight very special states. They're eight states such that the noughts and the ones here correspond to correct solutions to the problem. If Alice always answers with, they perform not one measurements now, they're just going to get one of these nine results. Alice, because she's got the first two systems, will get the first two bit outputs in her little glass cubicle. So if they get this outcome, Alice will get the answer naught naught, and Bob in his cubicle will get the answer naught naught. Then they just, Alice adopts a very simple procedure. Of the three numbers, the first two numbers she says are the two numbers that pop out here, and the third number she says is whatever she needs to say to make the set of three numbers even. So if her first two numbers were naught naught, she needs to say naught, so she answers naught naught naught. Likewise, Bob does the same, but he has to make his answers odd, so Bob in that case would answer naught naught one. But let's look at this. This is the state that occurs when we ask Alice question two and Bob question three, for example. So it's this state here. We're asking Bob this column and Alice this column here, that row. Say we just pick on the first result here, naught, naught, naught versus naught, naught, naught for Alice, naught, 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 versus naught, naught, one for Bob, naught, naught, one. Well, they both agree that this intersection is zero, so they win. And in fact, that's true for all eight of these. There's eight of these for a reason in the quantum state. It's kind of because there's eight possible correct squares here. There's a correspondence between the two. So the punchline is, you can perform experiments that basically test this kind of property with different experimental arms, one being Alice, one being Bob, where they are space-like separated from one another. So no signal could possibly get between the two. It's the ultimate in glass booths, space-like separation. And where you randomly ask Alice and Bob systems questions completely independently. If you have a quantum state to start with in your experiment, you can win this kind of game in the laboratory. You can win it every single damn time, as opposed to the maximum classical probability of winning of 8 times out of 9. And after you've played the game 100 times and won every single time, you start to suspect that maybe quantum mechanics is true. And our intuitions about how best to perform in game shows are wrong. But yeah, that's kind of quantum information theory in a nutshell. It's all random people wasting their time thinking about game shows when they should be working. That's not the kind of